As the sun beat down on Florida's eastern coast, Charles and Catherine Romer climbed into their black Lincoln Continental and headed north. They had a long trip ahead of them, 1,400 miles home to New York. They'd done it dozens of times before, but this time they would never make it. Crossing into Georgia, the couple stopped at the same hotel they always did, checked into their room, unpacked, and settled in. Sometime within the next 2 hours, the Romers and their car would mysteriously vanish. Investigators launched the largest search effort in the history of southern Georgia, covering more than 700 square miles of land, rivers, ocean, and swamp. They brought in the FBI, state police, GBI, private investigators joined the search, and in desperation, even psychics were consulted. Despite thousands of hours of effort, not a single trace of the Romers or their car has ever been found. Some believe the couple was targeted. They were well off, drove a brand new customized luxury car, and Catherine was decked out in platinum rings, diamonds, and gold. Could it have been all an accident? Their fate submerged somewhere deep beneath the water? Or was it always all about the money? This is Trace Evidence, episode 173, The Vanishing of Charles and Catherine Romer. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine one of the most mysterious disappearances in the history of Georgia. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. It was a drive they'd made dozens of times, on roads they knew, in a place they felt safe. Yet somehow Charles and Catherine Romer never made it home, and what became of them remains a mystery nearly half a century later. This is episode 173, The Vanishing of Charles and Catherine Romer. The dark water of the St. Mary's River flows slowly, the current winding around large twists and curves slicing through the landscape like a black serpent slithering towards the ocean. Emerging slowly from the dark waters of the Okefenokee Swamp, the river coils and unfurls, doubling back as it moves south before sharply changing course, flowing northeast towards the Cumberland Sound. Interstate 95 moves steadily north, the heated blacktop running in a straight line through a patchwork of still, green trees and shivering brown fields. Concrete and steel rises like a spine of stone arching over the expanse of the river, which marks the transition moving out of Florida, arriving on the opposite bank in southern Georgia. The afternoon sun had already begun its shift, moving away from its perch in the sky in a slow but steady slump towards the horizon, as a long black car sailed over the river. While for many, the river simply marks the space where two states meet, it told Charles and Catherine Romer that their seven-hour journey was nearly complete. Early that morning, the couple had packed up their belongings and loaded them into the trunk of their Lincoln to make the journey home to New York, having waited out the brutal winter months in the comfort of their Miami apartment. It was a trip they made every year, and their first stop was less than 30 minutes away in Brunswick, Georgia. As the most major city and economic hub in southern Georgia, Brunswick comes in only second to Savannah as the largest developed area along the state's coast. Jutting out like a stone against the sea, the peninsula spills south into the East River, nearly bridging the gap between Jekyll and St. Simon's Island. A popular location for travelers seeking out sun and excitement, it was but a rest stop for the Romers, who had several more days of driving ahead of them and planned to take the coast all the way home to New York. Shifting his hand, Charles nudged his indicator upward, the resounding click of the turn signal blinking in a measured pace. As he maneuvered the wheel, the dark coupe exited the interstate, passing into the northwest corner of the city. Less than a mile down the road, the couple pulled into the parking lot of the Holiday Inn, the same hotel they always stayed in for their first stop of the trip. Climbing out from the black Lincoln, Charles arched his back, splaying his arms out to the sides as he tried to stretch the soreness from his body. Walking around to the trunk, he slid the key into the lock and lifted the lid. Grabbing two handfuls of luggage, Charles was joined by Catherine, a little road-weary, and together they walked inside, approaching the front desk. Charles gave their name to the concierge, who pulled up their reservations and directed them towards their room, both eager to sink into the comfort of a nice bed or comfortable armchair where they could stretch their legs and finally relax. Stepping into their room, the couple moved with the efficiency of travelers familiar with the process. Catherine opened the suitcases and began hanging clothes in the closet, while Charles produced a folder and spread paperwork on the corner desk, alongside a small journal where he kept notes about their trips. Pulling out a bottle of scotch, Charles poured a finger into one glass and then another. Setting the bottle down, he turned slightly, handing one of the glasses to Catherine, and the two clinked them together before taking a sip. Turning his attention back to the business at hand, Charles flipped open his map and smiled, noting that the next leg of the drive was far shorter. He liked getting the difficult part out of the way first. Unfortunately, neither he nor his wife would arrive at their next destination, as before the sun could even set over Brunswick that night, the couple would mysteriously vanish. 4 long days would pass before hotel staff realized something had gone terribly wrong and notified police, who had no way of knowing that they were about to examine one of the most mystifying and perplexing disappearances in Georgia state history. Charles Robert Romer was born on Monday, August 27th, 1906 in Cincinnati, Ohio, to parents John and Mabel. The Romers would go on to have several more children, with Charles gaining a brother and 2 sisters over the next few years. While born in Ohio, Charles would be raised in New Rochelle, a city in New York's Westchester County, where he'd live for the rest of his life. Smart, focused, and determined, Charles earned a reputation as a hard worker who had big dreams and all of the fire necessary to achieve them. By the time he entered his 20s, he was already climbing the ladder of success with a lucrative career in the oil business, eventually becoming an executive and manager of fuel oil sales. In the spring of 1928, Charles would attend the wedding of a friend, and there he would meet and fall in love with the 20-year-old Jane Ann O'Shea. A year later, on May 7th, 1929, Charles and Jane were married at the Church of the Holy Name in New Rochelle. The couple would go on to have 2 sons, Charles Robert Jr. and Richard James, who would be raised in their Wilmot Road home. Over the course of the next 40 years, Charles and Jane would watch as their boys grew up, going on to attend prestigious schools and, at least in terms of Charles Jr., following in their father's footsteps in the oil business. One of Charles' favorite places to visit was Florida, specifically Miami, where he owned a co-op apartment in the luxurious Seaview Hotel. After his retirement from working life, Charles and Jane made it a habit to head down to sunny Miami after the holidays, where they'd spend the first few months of the year avoiding the brutal cold of upstate New York winters. The couple was very socially engaged, hosting parties, attending equestrian events, and everything in between. Sadly, Jane became ill and ultimately passed away in December of 1973 at the age of 65. Charles turned to his close friends for support during this difficult time and found both comfort and eventually love in Catherine Heller, who had suffered a similar loss some years earlier. Catherine Blanchfield was born on Sunday, July 20th, 1902 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to parents Thomas and Mary. Catherine was the couple's second child, and she would go on to have 2 sisters and 2 brothers over the next few years. Catherine attended local school, and when she got older, eventually got a job working as a stenographer. In 1925, when she was 23, Catherine met and fell for Frank Heller, a native New Yorker 13 years her senior. After a courtship of several months, the two would marry on March 29, 1926, settling into a home on Kensington Road in Scarsdale, New York. Frank was the president of Raymond & Heller's Corporation and also sat as a chairman over seven real estate firms, among other duties. Heller had a reputation for being polite, kind, and intelligent, with a dapper sense of style, and Catherine blended perfectly into his high-profile life. The couple would go on to have a son, Frank Jr., and they'd spare no expense for his education, seeing him attending private schools and eventually Georgetown. Catherine thoroughly enjoyed her sociable lifestyle, hosting parties and becoming involved in clubs around town. One of her biggest passions was horses. She and Frank often held various equestrian events on their property in Scarsdale. They also took the horses south to Florida, where they too owned a space in the Sea View, and they would often run into their good friends, Charles and Jane Romer. The Hellers made their last trip to Florida together in the early months of 1965, where their names appear in association with several horse races and events. Unfortunately, not long after returning home, Frank passed away on May 10th at the age of 72. Devastated by the loss of her husband, Catherine continued moving forward with her life in the best way she knew how. Throughout his life, Frank had accumulated a good deal of wealth, including multiple pieces of valuable property, all of which Catherine inherited. A smart woman with an eye for horses and good business, she managed her estate exceedingly well given the circumstances, though there was no denying that there was a loneliness settling in. 8 years later, Catherine and Charles, both having lost their spouses, found one another. What began as two friends comforting each other developed into something more emotional and romantic. They both spent their winters at the Sea View. They both lived in the same building in Scarsdale. They ran in the same circles and had been friends for years. It only made sense that they would eventually find their way together. Not looking to waste any time, Charles and Catherine married a year later, on December 3, 1974, at St. Thomas More's Church off Madison Avenue in Manhattan. At the time, Charles was 69 and Catherine was 72. After celebrating a short honeymoon at home, the couple began making plans for their next trip to Florida. Over the course of the next few years, the relationship between the newlyweds continued to blossom, and it seemed that, in their grief, they had been joined together. They continued to winter in Florida and spent the rest of their years at their apartment in Scarsdale, a building that Catherine actually owned. By the end of the decade, they were celebrating 5 loving years together, but neither knew this would be the last anniversary either of them would ever see. On Thursday, January 3rd, 1980, the couple boarded a plane heading for Miami. Getting older and not feeling as comfortable driving in winter weather as they used to be, the couple decided to fly down and have their car shipped, figuring they would make the drive home a few months later. They had no idea that they would never make it back. For the next 3 months, Charles and Catherine enjoyed their time at the Sea View on Collins Avenue in Bal Harbour, just north of Miami Beach. Easter of that year fell on Sunday, April 6th, and this would be the last time any of the family heard from either of them. That day, Charles placed a call to his son, Charles Jr., living in New Jersey at the time, and wished him a happy holiday. When discussing plans for their return to Scarsdale, Charles explained that he and Catherine were leaving Florida 2 days later and would be following their normal routine. Having made the trip countless times over the years, Charles had developed a set pattern they followed, stopping at the same locations every time. The first stop was set to be the Holiday Inn off I-95 in Brunswick, Georgia, just 30 miles across the state line. During the next 48 hours, the couple packed up their luggage and began loading it into their new prized car, a customized 1979 two-door Lincoln Continental shining in satin black. Less than 24 hours later, Charles and Catherine would baffle police, family, and friends alike when they seemingly disappeared along with their distinct custom luxury car. According to investigators, the Romers left their Bal Harbour apartment between 8:30 and 9 a.m. on the morning of Tuesday, April 8th. With the first leg of the trip targeting Brunswick as the destination, the couple would need to drive just over 400 miles north, the vast majority of which would be via I-95. In driving time, this would be approximately 6 to 7 hours, though there would likely be stops for gas, food, restrooms, and just to stretch their legs. According to everything the police determined, there were no major issues along the way, traffic was moving easily, and the roamers had a fairly clear road ahead of them. According to the official timeline, the roamers exited from I-95, taking exit 38 towards Brunswick at approximately 3:40 p.m. From there, it would be a quick turn onto Highway 341 and a straight shot to the Holiday Inn. Upon arrival, Charles and Catherine entered the hotel and approached the front desk, at which time their reservation was confirmed. Register logs from the Holiday Inn showed that the couple finished checking in at 3:51 p.m., at which time they were assigned to a room on the first floor. Taking a few bags with them, they entered the room and dropped them off before heading back out to the parking lot to gather the rest of their luggage. This second time, the couple entered the room, and it's noted that this is the last time anyone on the hotel staff ever saw them. According to the phone records, the last time anyone actually spoke to either Charles or Catherine was at 4:17 p.m. Charles called in to their Scarsdale home and spoke to the maid, informing her that they expected to be home in 48 hours late on Thursday the 10th, and he requested that she chill some glasses for cocktail hour for when they arrived. The next time anyone reports seeing the roamers is at approximately 5 p.m., when a Georgia State trooper spotted their black Lincoln on a state highway. Curiously, though, the state trooper told investigators that when he saw the car, it was moving south on a state highway back towards Florida's state line, which is less than 40 miles south of the Holiday Inn. According to the Daily News, there was nothing in particular about the car that drew suspicion from the trooper. What caught his attention was the license plate, a New York plate reading CRRCBR, the couple's initials. There is another reported sighting also attributed to a state trooper. This time the vehicle is seen not long after 5 p.m., but it is parked south of Brunswick at a shopping strip where there's multiple restaurants. I should note, though, there seems to be some confusion about this sighting. Most reports either give the account of the trooper that saw them driving or the one that saw them parked. For the life of me, I couldn't determine which is actually an accurate account or if perhaps both are accurate accounts. However, their official NamUs makes note of the Lincoln being parked at the restaurants. Unfortunately, no one has ever publicly stated where exactly these restaurants were, so whether they're 5 miles from the hotel or 20, we simply don't know. What we do know is Charles and Catherine Roamer never made it back to the hotel that night. At approximately 9:30 a.m. the next morning, Wednesday, April 9th, a housekeeper making the rounds knocked on the Roamer's door but received no answer. Assuming they weren't in, she used her master key to open the door so she could freshen up the room. According to the woman, nothing in particular stood out to her about the room other than the fact that while the bed cover had been pulled down, it didn't look like anyone had actually slept in the bed the night before. Having no reason to think anything more about it, she finished cleaning up the room and moved on to the next. According to hotel staff, over the next 2 days, they had no contact with the roamers, though housekeeping continued to clean their room each morning. Strangely, their reservation had been for only one night, so why no one at the hotel tried to find them after several days passed has never been fully explained. It wouldn't be until Saturday, April 12th, 4 days since they were last seen, that anyone thought there might be a reason for concern. Reportedly, the housekeeper who had entered the room on Wednesday was working, and when she entered the room again this time, she found it worrisome that absolutely nothing in the room had been touched. She promptly reported this to hotel management, who placed a call to the Glynn County Police Department. Charles' son, Charles Jr., was beginning to get worried around the same time. He hadn't heard from his father since Easter Sunday, and it wasn't like him to go this long without making contact. On Friday, April 11th, Jr. tried to reach the couple at their home in Scarsdale, knowing they should have made it back by now. He later told the Daily Item, quote, "I tried to reach them on Friday. There was no answer. I assumed they had gone out to dinner early and had gone to bed. I didn't want to bother them." End quote. Around the same time the housekeeper was entering their room that Saturday, Jr. was beginning to worry. He tried to reach his parents again, placing a call at 9:15 a.m., but once again, there was no answer. At the time, he wondered if they'd run into an issue on the road, so he started trying to track them down. Knowing exactly what route his father always took and where he always stayed, Junior began with the stops closest to Scarsdale and slowly made his way further south. When he spoke to the manager at the South Carolina Kiowa Island Inn, he learned that the couple had never arrived, missing their reservation. At approximately 11 a.m., an officer from the Glynn County Police Department was dispatched to the hotel. At the time, no one realized this was a missing persons situation, and in fact, hotel staff initially considered that the couple might have left after the second day in an attempt to skip out on paying for an additional night spent in the room. The officer on the scene requested entry to the Romer's room so he could check and see if there was any obvious signs of trouble, and in all reality, it was the absence of any sign that made him believe the couple was in danger. Investigators later report that upon entering the room, they found it in good shape. Several pieces of empty luggage were stacked in the corner with their contents hanging in the closet. There was a bottle of scotch and two empty glasses sitting on one of the nightstands, a pair of glasses and a novel on the other. On the desk were several financial documents, including tax forms as well as the couple's checkbook. Several potted plants, which Catherine wanted to bring home to New York, were sitting on the floor. On the desk, beside the financial papers, was a small journal belonging to Charles. According to his children, he was very methodical and often made notes about his day in the book. Glancing through, police noted that the last entry completed was April 7th, the day before they'd left Florida. A new entry for the 8th had been started, and Charles had made notes about friends they'd spoken to, restaurants they'd eaten at, and it mentioned the resort they planned to stop at in South Carolina. However, it was clear that Charles never got to finish that entry. Searching through the room, police managed to locate six pieces of jewelry which belonged to Catherine. According to her son, Frank, she was in the habit of bringing her most prized jewelry with her to Florida and would often wear several expensive pieces out to dinner and around the apartment. It was later stated that the value of the jewelry left behind in the hotel room was in the neighborhood of $500,000, according to the Florida Times Union. Approximately $150,000 worth of jewelry was missing and was likely being worn by Catherine. These items were noted as being a platinum ring with a 5.5-carat emerald-cut diamond valued at $50,000, a pair of platinum and diamond earrings that contained 50 diamonds, and two other pairs of earrings valued at $25,000. When later asked about his mother wearing such expensive jewelry on a trip, Frank told the Palm Beach Post that that was just how she was, saying, quote, "You were so used to seeing it on her. She had been doing this for years. She wasn't going to change," end quote. Once the room had been searched and no signs of foul play were discovered, police told hotel staff to seal the room and stay out. Realizing that this was a bad situation, the Glynn County Police sent additional officers and detectives to the hotel. Captain Felton Buddy Andrews was given the difficult task of contacting the family to notify them, but wasn't exactly sure what to say. While it was clear that Charles and Catherine weren't at the hotel, they hadn't found a single piece of evidence to indicate that any crime had actually occurred. Speaking to Junior, Captain Andrews explained the situation and requested photos of the couple so that they could show them to potential witnesses and create missing persons flyers. Junior told Andrews that he would be on the next flight to Georgia and would bring the photos with him. Andrews next placed a call to the Bal Harbour Police in Florida and requested that they head down to the Sea View and take a look through the Romer's apartment. While nothing of value was found in the room, police did speak to several neighbors and employees who confirmed that the couple had left Tuesday morning without any issue. At some point, Captain Andrews received a call from the FBI wanting to know what was happening, but they didn't have a great deal of information right at the start. Since the case didn't fall under FBI jurisdiction, they couldn't be involved directly, though they did reach out to the Scarsdale police, requesting that they conduct a search of the Romer's home, though much like Florida, nothing of evidentiary value was found. When Junior arrived in Brunswick, investigators took him to the hotel room so that he could note any items that might be missing. After looking through everything left behind, outside of the jewelry Catherine was likely wearing, the only other items missing were her purse, Charles's wallet, and the black Lincoln. According to Junior, his father typically carried between $400 and $500 cash with him, and he had multiple credit cards in his wallet. Detectives questioned hotel staff and then, taking copies of the Romer's photos, began expanding outward to try and track down anyone who might have seen or interacted with the couple in the days prior. The first person they spoke to who claimed to have seen the Romers was a local contractor named Jim Wilson. According to police, Wilson stated that he had spoken with an older couple who closely resembled Charles and Catherine on Jekyll Island, approximately 20 miles from the Holiday Inn, around 3 p.m. on Tuesday the 8th. Wilson claims that the couple were sightseeing, and they briefly chatted about fishing. He later noted that he saw them speaking to another couple a few minutes later. While he couldn't remember much about the second couple, he believed they were also New Yorkers. While this witness could be important, Charles Jr. didn't think he'd actually spoken to his parents at all. Explaining his skepticism to the Daily Item, Jr. stated, quote, "The witness said he met them on the pier before they checked into the hotel and that they were wearing shorts. But neither one of them wears shorts, particularly if they're traveling in the car. In fact, I doubt they own a pair of shorts." End quote. Whether Jim Wilson actually saw the Romers or had confused them with another couple has never been determined. What had seemed like the first real clue in the case was now discredited, and they were back to square one. Descriptions of Charles and Catherine, as well as their car, were sent to every law enforcement department along the East Coast from Miami to Scarsdale in hopes that someone might see them or the Black Lincoln. Since several days had passed between the Romers' disappearance and police becoming aware, they didn't have the ability to question any guests who may have been staying at the hotel on the 8th and had since checked out. Several letters were mailed out to addresses for those guests, but they only received one in response. It came from a female guest who told police that she had seen the Romers standing in the doorway of their hotel room speaking to another couple at approximately 6 p.m. on the 8th. While she couldn't give much detail, the witness described the unknown couple as being well-dressed and in their early to mid-40s. The woman also included that the unknown couple had a small, rare breed of dog with them. While police tried to corroborate this account, they weren't able to find any other witnesses who had seen this couple in the hotel that night. Trying to keep things moving, Captain Andrews began organizing search parties. Utilizing his department, local volunteers, agents from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and the state police, he aimed to cover all of Glynn County from corner to corner, searching for any trace of the Romers in what at the time was called the biggest search in the history of southern Georgia. Officers distributed pictures of the Romers in their car to every gas station, restaurant, and rest stop along a 120-mile stretch of I-95 from Savannah in the north to the Florida state line. Searches were conducted on land, sea, and air, scouring heavily wooded areas, steep hillsides, and all beachfront resorts. Scuba divers were sent into every body of water inside of a 20-mile radius, and each island off the coast was searched on foot and by helicopters hovering above. Perhaps the most difficult task involved a slow, step-by-step search of the Okefenokee Swamp, which spreads out over 700 square miles. While it was incredibly difficult and time-consuming, over the course of the next 2 weeks, searchers covered every square mile of Glynn County. A change in the weather had made it more challenging as torrential rains battered the areas for several days, slowing down and delaying the efforts of everyone involved. Despite all of this, not a single trace was found. No shred of clothing, a wallet, not even a tire mark which could be attributed to that car. The Lincoln would become a key part of the search, with investigators believing if they could find it, then they'd at least have a direction to focus in on. Without the car, they were searching for a needle in a haystack. By Tuesday, April 22nd, 2 weeks had passed since anyone had seen Charles or Catherine, and despite all of the efforts being made by law enforcement, they were no closer to an answer than when they had begun. Considering that a state trooper had seen the Lincoln driving south of Brunswick the day they vanished, Investigators considered the possibility that the roamers had decided to go out to dinner and somewhere along the way had run into trouble. Considering the high value of the car, the missing jewelry, they wondered if perhaps the roamers had caught the eye of someone looking to rob them and things had gotten out of control. Junior wasn't fully convinced by this theory, though, feeling that it was out of character for his father. Speaking to the Miami Herald, he explained, quote, "They'd be tired after driving that long. They weren't the type that went sightseeing. Usually they'd just check into a hotel, have a drink in their room, go down to dinner in a hotel restaurant, and then go to bed. It's very unusual that they'd go out again. My gut feeling is that something happened here at the hotel, not in the hotel, but possibly in the parking lot." End quote. Investigators were beginning to get a similar feeling, wondering if maybe someone had gained entry to the hotel room and abducted the couple, or perhaps had planned to rob the room and were interrupted in the middle of it. One thing was for sure, however. If indeed the roamers had been abducted by someone, then the chances of them being alive were extremely slim, as no member of the family nor anyone in law enforcement had received any calls or letters with ransom demands. In a disappearance that has infinitely more questions than answers, yet another strange detail emerged. According to the Journal News, hotel staff told investigators that the couple's reservation had been placed through an agency, though they hadn't gotten the name of it. This was surprising to Junior, who noted that typically those businesses are paid a commission for their services and invoices are issued within 10 days of a reservation being honored. More than 2 weeks had passed, and no travel agencies had tried to collect their payment, leading police to wonder just what agencies the roamers had hired. Unfortunately, that's yet another unanswered question to add to the list. News coverage about the roamers' disappearance began to build up, with articles being published up and down the East Coast. While there wasn't much detail to give, the story was full of holes. It did drum up attention, which resulted in a slew of tips being called in from all over the country. A caller from New Jersey told police she thought she'd seen the black Lincoln traveling on Route 80, just 40 miles outside of New York City. A married couple in Tennessee called in to report they'd seen an older couple driving a black Lincoln days earlier. They stated that while they couldn't visually identify them as Charles and Catherine, they did notice what appeared to be hitchhikers traveling with them. None of these sightings could be confirmed, and like every tip police received, they couldn't verify it, or when they ran it down, it led nowhere. Investigators were just as baffled as the family, not understanding how after all of these searches and hours they'd put into the case, they'd yet to uncover a solid piece of evidence. At this point, while they knew they were looking at a missing persons case, they still hadn't found even enough evidence to officially state that foul play had been involved. Discussing the frustration, Charles Jr. told the Herald Statesman, quote, "The police are doing a very thorough job, but so far, we've been able to come up with nothing. I'm not convinced that they're even in the country anymore, or else we would have found them by now. You can't even think of the possibilities of what could have happened to them. They're very easygoing, fun-loving people. They don't have an enemy in the world." End quote. By Friday, April 25th, the case, which had never even warmed up in the first place, was now growing colder than it started. Desperate for something to break through and give them something to work with, Captain Andrews told the media that since their police methods hadn't helped, they were now going to take a more unconventional approach. Andrews explained that they'd received a call from a local woman who claimed to have seen the roamers' black Lincoln being driven out from a heavily wooded area near the Holiday Inn around the time of the disappearance. Unfortunately, the witness didn't get a good look at the driver or the license plate, so investigators were going to bring in a hypnotist in hopes that he might be able to unlock the woman's memories. Captain Andrews told the Herald that he'd been forced to cut back on investigators assigned to the case, but there were still three detectives working it full time. Still, they were staring at a blank page. At this point, the Glynn County Police, FBI, and the family agreed that, more than likely, Charles and Catherine had been abducted, perhaps for the purpose of robbery, within 2 hours of checking into the hotel. This would mean that they had disappeared sometime between 4:30 and 6:30 p.m., and whoever had been responsible had a 4-day head start putting distance between themselves and Brunswick. According to Andrews, under the advice of the FBI field office in New Rochelle, they were considering reaching out to a well-known psychic in hopes that she could lend them some assistance. Asked if the investigation was truly so barren as to necessitate the help of a so-called psychic, Captain Andrews replied, quote, "We have not a shred of firm evidence. We're still looking for something to open a case file. There's just no evidence of any crime." End quote. Dorothy Allison was a self-proclaimed psychic detective living in Nutley, New Jersey. Beginning in the 1960s, Allison consulted on multiple investigations, including the 1974 kidnapping of Patty Hearst, the 1976 Son of Sam murders, and the Atlanta Child murders. While some investigators praised Allison, claiming that she provided them with helpful information leading to the discovery of bodies and the identification of suspects, others were less kind about her abilities. Two detectives in New Jersey later accused Allison of offering them money to say that she had helped their investigation, while detectives working the Atlanta Child murders noted she did little more than provide them with 42 names of potential suspects, none of which ended up being involved. According to the Glynn County Police, Allison led them to several wooded areas and suggested that they might find clues there. Tracking dogs were brought in to assist with ground searches of these locations, though no evidence related to the roamers was found. Beyond the wooded areas, Allison made reference to a white car and a field full of flowers being connected to the case, but again, this did little to help anyone. According to Sergeant Bob Pittman, Allison claimed that Charles and Catherine would be found in a basement, but the car was not in the same place as the bodies. Several basements were searched, but again, nothing was found. Pittman went on to tell the Brunswick News, quote, "She repeatedly told us that we should be looking in the oldest part of town, so we searched the south end of town, including the old hospital building, but we didn't find anything." End quote. Having hit yet another dead end and with no signs that things would be changing, investigators had little more they could do than repeat their previous steps. They searched again, this time expanding north into Camden County and south into McIntosh. They checked in ditches along interstates and highways and crawled over salt flats and boggy swamps. They re-interviewed hotel staff and potential witnesses, made the rounds with the media, and pushed for assistance from the public, but every lead fell apart when they ran it down. Soon, time began passing more rapidly with no developments, no information, or even new theories. By July, the case was ice cold, with Captain Andrews telling the Daily Times, quote, "As far as having an active investigation, well, we don't have enough information to continue any sort of investigation." End quote. The next month, in August, Charles Jr. and Richard petitioned a judge in Westchester Surrogate Court asking him to name an administrator to manage the couple's estate. According to New York state law, an individual must be missing for at least 5 years and there has to be a direct and concerted effort to locate them before they can legally be declared dead. Due to this, Charles's sons hoped to obtain control of the estate until their father was found or those 5 years passed. They also requested that the judge officially mark April 8th as the day the couple disappeared. According to court documents at the time, Charles's estate was valued at $1.25 million, while Catherine's was at $1 million. Her son, Frank, was petitioning to obtain control of her estate in his own court filings. In the meantime, Charles Jr. and Richard hired the Wackett Hut Corporation, a world-renowned private investigation firm, to conduct their own investigation. They sent a team of investigators to Brunswick to survey the area, interview witnesses, spread information about the case, and hopefully produce some answers. At the same time, the case was still being looked at by the Glynn County Police, Georgia Bureau of Investigation, State Police, and FBI. In September, Captain Andrews sat down to speak with the Marietta Journal. Asked about the status of the case, he replied, quote, "We still follow up on any leads we get, but we just haven't gotten any. We talked back and forth with the FBI, but we haven't heard anything there. Nothing was ever found. None of their credit cards ever showed up. We're just on a holding pattern, waiting for something to develop. We thought by now the car would have turned up, or perhaps their bodies, but so far, nothing. End quote. The case grew quiet and fell from the headlines. 1980 came to a close without the slightest hint of what might have happened to Charles and Catherine Romer. April of 81 marked a full year since the Romers had mysteriously vanished, but little about the case had changed. Tom McKeon, an investigator for the Wackenhut Corporation, explained to the media that his team was still on the case, though they hadn't found much either. Their biggest lead revolved around a male guest at the hotel who claimed to have seen the Romers leaving by themselves at approximately 7 p.m. the night they vanished. Unfortunately, they hadn't been able to interview that witness more thoroughly because they couldn't find him, noting only that he lived in Pennsylvania. Throwing a little shade at the local police, McKeon noted that his team felt certain angles of the case that should have been investigated hadn't been, and that they believed detectives might have overlooked some loose ends, though McKeon didn't go into detail about what those loose ends might have been. Lieutenant R.J. Smiley of the Glynn County Police was as perplexed a year later as he had been during the early part of the investigation. While the primary theory seemed to be that Charles and Catherine had either been targeted at the hotel or perhaps while en route to dinner, Smiley had his own angle to it, telling the Atlanta Constitution that it was possible the couple had been followed up from Florida by jewel thieves who had noticed Catherine's expensive jewelry, but even he admitted it was a stretch. As for Captain Andrews, he had little choice but to confront the harsh reality of the investigation, which, in all reality, never really got off the ground. Speaking to the Herald Statesman, he explained, quote, "There's really not a thing else we can do. We've searched the entire county and shared every bit of information we had with the FBI. The only thing we can think of, and it's only speculation, is that jewel thieves surprised them in their room. It's a known fact that in the Miami area, these people hang around resorts and watch tourists. There's a lot of water around. It would be very easy to weigh a body down and dispose of it in some body of water. Although we've had divers in the waters all over the territory, and they've come up with nothing." End quote. From the first moment investigators arrived on the scene, through weeks of searches and interviews, running down hundreds of tips and even hoping against hope by bringing in a psychic, there simply was nothing to work with. No suspects, no rumors, no vengeful enemies or criminal acquaintances. It was as if Charles, Catherine, and their Lincoln vanished from the face of the earth. Life began to move on. New crimes required the attention of investigators. Jobs and family called the children back from the Georgia streets. And soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. In early October of 1985, 5.5 years since they disappeared, both Charles and Catherine were legally declared dead. Their date of death was listed as being April 8th. The cause and place of death were marked as undetermined. Charles Jr. and Richard were assigned executors to their father's will, which split his estate down the middle between them, outside of several thousand dollars of charitable donations. Catherine's son Frank became the sole beneficiary of her estate in a separate hearing. After all those years, the truth was still out of reach. Robbery was considered the most likely motive, but by who, how, and when, no one could really say. For Captain Andrews, the case hadn't been looked at in a few years, as he told the Daily Times, quote, "We could certainly investigate any leads that come in, but we just ran out of things to do. We haven't had a real lead in years." End quote. This same year, investigators looked into a possible connection between the Romers' disappearance and two notorious and violent killers. Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole were examined closely, with investigators going so far as to bring Lucas to that Holiday Inn. While Lucas said the hotel looked familiar, he couldn't remember if he'd ever stayed there before, and detectives couldn't find anything to directly link either man to the disappearance. They had been, for the most part, grasping at straws. But when you've got absolutely nothing for 5 years, sometimes straws are worth reaching for. Despite the passage of time and the frustration of never having much, if any, evidence to work with, the search for Charles and Catherine haunted their children, who, each year, came down to Georgia, hoping to finally find some answers. Charles once said that they would never stop searching for the truth, but the cruel fate of time ultimately halted that endeavor. Richard James Romer passed away in 1992 at the age of 54. 9 years later, in 2001, Frank Heller Jr. died at the age of 75. 6 years after that, in 2007, Charles Jr. passed away in Florida at the age of 76. The search for answers now comes down to their children, a painful mystery handed down like a haunted heirloom to the next generation. While many in Brunswick have never heard the bizarre and mysterious story of Charles and Catherine Romer, there is one man who has never forgotten or given up. George Baker was 34 in 1980 and worked as an auxiliary police officer for the telephone company and as a diver for the Glynn County Emergency Management Agency. He was in the water during those early searches, and over the course of 30 years, he went back in hundreds of times, hoping to find the answers somewhere beneath the murky waters. At different times, he focused on different places, from Fancy Bluff Creek to the South Brunswick River. The more time passed, the more he believed that maybe the reason no evidence of a crime was discovered was because there was no crime. Baker began theorizing that maybe after leaving the hotel that night to grab dinner, Charles and Catherine might have accidentally driven into one of the many lakes and rivers in the area. He took it upon himself to continue the search whenever he had a free moment to do so. He braved dangerous waters and found countless cars, but never that custom 1979 Lincoln. At one point, he found a woman who claimed that her husband had seen that car that April night in 1980. Driving erratically, the big car forced the man to veer off the side of the road. Talking to the Brunswick News, Baker showed them an invoice from April 8, 1980, proving that the man was definitely in the area delivering items. As times change, so does technology. And even well into his 60s, Baker was still going down to search. In the latter years, his focus loomed on an old bridge, now a boat ramp, not far from where Highway 303 spans the South Brunswick River. Despite hundreds of dives with no answers, Baker's continued the search well beyond the bounds of anyone in an official capacity. It became his quest, but unfortunately, as has been the case with everyone who has tried to pry the truth from the dark, he's always come up empty-handed. Perhaps he's right, and the answers are somewhere beneath the water, but there's no way of knowing if indeed the right body of water is even in Glynn County. Charles Robert Romer and Catherine Heller Romer mysteriously vanished sometime between the hours of 4 and 7 p.m. from Brunswick, Georgia on Tuesday, April 8, 1980. More than 40 years have passed, and for a case with so many questions, almost no answers have been found. No trace of the Romers, their custom two-door satin black 1979 Lincoln Continental, or Catherine's jewelry has ever turned up. People don't simply vanish one night after checking into a hotel room, but a case like this can really make you think. In the end, though, a father and a mother were lost, leaving behind grieving children and a mystery that continues to haunt the family to this day. Maybe someday, the answers will finally reveal themselves and it will all make sense. But until then, the truth remains as elusive as the Romers themselves. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Check out betterhelp.com/trace. Life is full of stressors. It doesn't matter who you are, what you have, your life is probably stressful. I know for me, it can be challenging to keep up with the demands of work, home, and family life while also trying to find time to unwind, clear my head, and just take a break from the everyday chaos that life throws at you. You may not be feeling down and out and depressed, or like you're at a total loss, but if your stress is high, your temper is shorter than usual, or even if you're starting to feel strain in any of your relationships, you could probably use the chance to unload, and that's what therapy can be. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Unload the stressors and get some unbiased feedback. You'd be pretty surprised at what you might gain from it. See if it's for you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Trace Evidence listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/trace. That's BETTERHELP.com/trace. Imagine if every crime could be halted before it happened. Well, while you can't stop every criminal in their tracks, what if you could deter them? That's what SimpliSafe's new wireless outdoor security camera does. It's wireless, so it can install anywhere, extending SimpliSafe's perimeter of defense from your windows and doors to the far corners of your property. That's right. SimpliSafe, the system that U.S. News & World Report names Best Home Security System of 2021, just got even better. This brand new outdoor security camera is engineered with all the advanced tech and security features you want and need to help keep you and your family safe. It has an ultra-wide 140-degree field of view, so you can keep watch over your entire yard. It has 1080p HD resolution with an 8x zoom. That means you can zoom in clearly and see things like faces and license plates to capture critical evidence. And it has an easy-to-remove rechargeable battery, so it doesn't need an outlet and can go anywhere on your property. This camera has it all, and it integrates with your SimpliSafe home security system, extending its protection to the outside. Together, it means every door, window, and room are protected, and now your property will be too. To learn more about the exciting new SimpliSafe wireless outdoor security camera, visit simplisafe.com/trace. SimpliSafe is offering 20% off your entire new system and your first month of monitoring service free when you enroll in interactive monitoring. Again, that's simplisafe.com/trace. In some cases, there's so much evidence that it's difficult to understand why the answers haven't been found. In others, there's so little evidence you can't imagine how it even fits into the crime. When it comes to the disappearance of Charles and Catherine Romer, there isn't really any evidence at all. There are witness accounts, none of which can be verified. There's sightings, though whether they're accurate or not, no one knows. This is a situation where investigators started in the dark and never really found the light switch. In a lot of investigations, police hold information back, clues or pieces of evidence that are so vital they don't want to compromise the case by releasing them to the public. I don't think that exists here. After more than 40 years, it's hard to imagine they've never found anything. Somewhere in Glynn County, the file for this investigation is loaded with notes about searches, transcripts of witness statements, and the timeline of the Romers' travel, but the evidence locker is empty, and the investigation itself is nearly forgotten. So how did two people vanish into thin air? Well, logically, they can't. Something had to have caused them to fall off the grid, whether that be a criminal act or an accident or something unforeseen. We know almost everywhere Charles and Catherine were that warm day in April, but once the clock struck 5 p.m., they disappeared from the record along with their car, a large, hard-to-miss black Lincoln. Ultimately, the theories developed during this investigation have, for the most part, remained the same since the early days. The Romers may have been targeted by thieves looking for Catherine's jewelry, the car, or both. Maybe it was random. Someone saw them and decided to go for it. Maybe it was more complicated, following them out of Florida to strike when they were vulnerable. Then there's the possibility that there was no crime at all. That in the end, Charles and Catherine vanished after losing control of the car and falling into the water below. So let's begin there. To say there's a lot of water around Brunswick is an understatement. Brunswick sits on a peninsula, and multiple rivers come together, pouring into the sound between St. Simon Island and Jekyll Island. The East River flows down along the west coast of Brunswick, sweeping south where it meets the South Brunswick River, and the two widen and combine to form the St. Simon Sound. The McKay and Black Rivers run up from the southern tip along the eastern edge between Brunswick and the McKinnon-St. Simon Island Airport. Branches of various rivers move inland, fanning out in different directions and growing shallow. Several bridges span different areas. I-95 crosses the South Brunswick not too far downriver from where Highway 303 does. The Sydney Lanier Bridge is 5 miles south of both, crossing the same river and linking the mainland of Georgia to the peninsula of Brunswick. The Jekyll Island Causeway connects to the mainland not far from Sydney Lanier. The dark waters of the Okefenokee Swamp sit just 30 minutes southwest of the Holiday Inn, and their murky depths are home to alligators, among other dangers. I don't think it's difficult to imagine that somewhere, somehow, the roamers could have run off the road and found themselves injured and sinking fast beneath the water. A lot of the waterways can be easily ruled out. They're not deep enough to have swallowed the whole car without it being easily noticeable from the surface. In many areas, there's thick mud and clay that can swallow up a vehicle, but usually not its entirety. In terms of where the roamers could have fallen beneath the surface, there's really only a few logical options. The East River and the South Brunswick have gotten the most attention and in all reality are the most likely locations that could be holding some answers. We know the East River is certainly deep enough to pull down a car that might never be found. Two terrible tragedies over the years resulted in cars falling from an earlier version of the Sydney Lanier Bridge. Where 95 and 303 cross the South Brunswick, it's not quite as deep, but still deep enough to swallow a car and mash it down into the mud and clay below. Its waters run darker, making it difficult to see more than a few feet beneath the surface. Divers entering these waters face the challenge of essentially swimming into darkness that they can't begin to disperse. Technology available today makes that somewhat easier, but when you're looking down into the river without a place to start, that's a long, time-consuming process of searching for the remnants of a car that's been down there for 40 years. George Baker, the diver who has searched for the roamers all this time, focuses in on the South Brunswick in a space just west of the 303. In a spot where the bridge once stood, directly adjacent to the 303, there's now a boat ramp. A single, thin road runs parallel to the 303 and it stops just at the river's edge. According to Baker, there's at least 10 cars down there, though none of them has been identified as the Lincoln. The double-laned bridge of the I-95 is just 1,000 feet to the east of the 303. Today, its edges are guarded by short concrete walls that, if hit at a high enough speed, will do little more than increase the risk of flipping a vehicle up, over, and down into the water below, depending on its velocity. It's a similar situation for the 303, and who knows what conditions were like on these bridges back in 1980. The Sydney Lanier Bridge is safer, to say the least, but it's also a modern bridge opened in 2003. The previous version, which would have been there in 1980, was constructed in 1956 and was a vertical lift bridge, allowing it to open and permit the passage of ships. Two separate times, 15 years apart, ships struck that bridge, knocking pieces of it off and sending cars falling into the water below. On November 7, 1972, the African Neptune ship caused a lot of damage and resulted in 10 people's deaths. The second incident happened in 1987. I don't think it's impossible to believe that the roamers could have fallen into the water, perhaps from a bridge, perhaps through some different method. In episode 35, we discussed the disappearance of Danielle Imbo and Richard Patrone, and it's quite similar to this case. Two people, last seen driving, mysteriously vanish in an area where many believe there's a high likelihood they could have gone into the water. In that case, however, at least there is some information which suggests something else may have happened. When it comes to Charles and Catherine Roamer, it's almost anyone's guess as to what the right answer may be, but that's what makes this theory so plausible. Massive searches. Flyers handed out and put up over a 120-mile span. Thousands of search and rescue, law enforcement, and volunteers combing over every square mile of Glynn County. Helicopters, planes, jeeps, trucks, horses, four-wheelers. No one finds a thing. Nothing to even prove the roamers ever left their hotel that night. In a large portion of cases, when people disappear along with their car, usually, they're in the same place, a body of water. Finding that answer, though, is the true challenge. Over 40 years, no trace of the car has been located. None of Charles' credit cards were used. None of Catherine's jewelry has been found. You'd imagine if it was all out there, someone would have noticed by now. There's no way of knowing if this could have just been an accident. It's certainly as plausible as any of the other theories. Maybe the reason no suspects were found was because there was no one to find. Maybe the reason no evidence has been found to prove a crime occurred is because a crime did not occur. An accident, a mistake, it's hard to say. Charles was the driver, as far as we know, and he was medically sound outside of having high blood pressure. We know the night they vanished, they had a sip or two of scotch in their hotel room. Charles had already driven for 7 hours that day. At age 73, it likely wasn't the easiest or most comfortable trip. So you factor in some scotch, the sun going down. They always say that dusk and dawn are the most dangerous times for accidents. I wouldn't have a hard time believing something could have gone wrong. Now, while the water aspect is an option, there's something else to be considered. If indeed the couple did go into the river, there's the possibility that it wasn't due to their own actions. Someone could have run them off the road. Perhaps an erratic driver comes veering at them, they turn the wheel, and off they go. That person's unlikely to come forward and tell what they saw. They don't want to get in trouble, so they just keep quiet. I could believe something like that, too. However, there's a more sinister option. Charles and Catherine may have ended up in the river, perhaps weighed down, or still in their own car, but at the hands of someone who abducted and murdered them. So turning our attention towards the crime aspect, that someone else was involved, there's a lot of different possibilities here. You could be looking at something random. Charles and Catherine check into the hotel and someone who works there notices. They've got expensive luggage, nice jewelry, a beautiful luxury car. He notifies a friend who's a thief, or he himself is into that kind of thing. Or the roamers head out to dinner, and along the way someone sees the car and follows them. They see it's two older people, probably easy targets, and a plan starts to formulate. It doesn't have to be incredibly complicated. It could be as simple as coming across the wrong person at the wrong time. If you're someone local, or you just happen to be in the area and you're the type to commit robbery and murder, there couldn't have been two more readily available targets that night. Assuming Charles and Catherine left the hotel of their own volition, they could have run into anyone out there looking for trouble. You don't necessarily have to be a criminal genius to know how to get rid of a car and bodies, especially if you've got a high knowledge of the area. Secluded locations, lakes, and rivers that are easily accessible. Hell, maybe it didn't even start out with the intention of murdering anyone, but things got out of hand. Charles fought back, or one of the two experienced a medical issue, and once it became clear that someone was going to die, it's better not to leave any witnesses. In all honesty, the conclusion to the crime itself didn't even necessarily have to happen in Glynn County or Georgia. Someone somehow gets inside the car and abducts the couple at gunpoint. He orders Charles to drive, or he forces him to the side and begins driving himself. From Brunswick, there's a lot of different places someone could go. It's just a 4-hour drive to the Gulf of Mexico and a similar distance to Alabama. South Carolina's even closer, 75 miles north, with plenty of rivers and lakes along the way. If you know the area, if you've driven the coast before, you likely know enough of the back roads to avoid even being seen on major highways and interstates. Hell, Brunswick is home to a major port that has different ships going in and out of it all the time. Not to mention it's the primary port of entry for importing cars and trucks for several major companies, including Jaguar, Land Rover, Porsche, Mitsubishi, and Volvo, and it's the major exporting hub for Ford, GM, and Mercedes. So you've got ships specifically designed for the transport of vehicles, and while I assume this was looked into, it's never been mentioned before. So how hard would it be? A couple of guys come ashore, they find a target, and inside of an hour or two, that car's locked away for transport. You get over the open waters of the ocean, and any evidence that needs to be disposed of, such as the roamers themselves, is easy enough to do. 3 deep water terminals exist within 15 miles of the Holiday Inn, 2 on Brunswick's Peninsula and 1 across the East River right between I-95 to the west and the Sydney Lanier Bridge to the east. Is it likely this is what happened? Probably not. But it's certainly not so far-fetched that it becomes impossible. Not to mention, when you have a major port area that involves importing and exporting vehicles, especially some luxury ones, you've likely got people in the area who are looking to exploit that transaction. Moving out of Georgia, Florida was just a 40-minute drive to the south, and there's a lot of different places that bodies could be buried or a car disposed of. It's curious. Despite the massive searches that Glynn County conducted, there doesn't appear to have been any searching done in North Florida or even close to the state line. It's strange, especially since the roamers had come out of Florida and their car was allegedly seen heading south on a state highway around the time of their disappearance. You'd think someone would at least have taken a look around, and in fairness, maybe they did, but it seems quite apparent they weren't conducting a massive search like Glynn County did. More than likely, Florida law enforcement was made aware of the case and told to keep an eye out, but not much beyond that. So that leaves another possibility, that this crime may have been planned and executed by someone who either knew the roamers, or perhaps someone who was aware of them and what valuable items they were in possession of. Being that Charles followed the same route every year for decades, anyone with even a remote familiarity would probably be aware of where they were heading the day they left Florida. Being that they spent so many years wintering at the Seaview, anyone there from fellow residents to staff could have been knowledgeable about where they were going and when. If someone were close enough to have enough information, I don't know that they'd necessarily follow them out of Florida that morning, but maybe they'd have been in Brunswick already waiting for them. You have a couple of different options with that. Someone that the roamers viewed as a friend could have used that closeness to disarm them and find out exactly what they needed to know. This person doesn't have to pull the crime off themselves. They just have to know enough to set up the plan so that someone else can execute it. You really have no way of knowing what someone might do to obtain hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry that can easily be cut up, fenced, and sold away for a nice percentage. Then you've got the other side of the coin. Someone who knows the roamers but doesn't like them or has an issue with them. Maybe it's jealousy. Maybe they've hit hard times and need some fast money. I know in these cases, friends and family always say they had no enemies, but trust me, even the nicest person in the world has enemies. And while I didn't know the roamers, two wealthy people who've been around for a long time have likely encountered a few people through their lives who, for one reason or another, might want to see them harmed or robbed. There is the intriguing mention of the roamers being seen talking to a couple. Jim Wilson, the man who claimed to have spoken to them on Jekyll Island, said they also spoke to another older couple who he thought were from New York. Now, Charles Jr. ruled this guy out because he described them as wearing shorts, but maybe he misremembered or transposed their clothing in his mind. Maybe it was a different couple entirely, we don't know. But what makes his account interesting is there's some corroboration. A woman staying at the Holiday Inn, who presumably has no connection to Wilson, tells investigators that she saw the roamers talking and laughing with another couple at the door of their room. She described them as in their 40s, well-dressed, and in possession of a rare breed of dog. So, more than likely, we're talking about people with some money, or people who are making themselves appear as though they have money, or perhaps people who knew Charles and Catherine or were trying to befriend them. Now, while law enforcement has theorized over the years that perhaps the roamers were abducted from their room or came across a robbery in progress, I find that somewhat difficult to believe. No one reported any loud sounds. No one ever saw the roamers walking out of the hotel with anyone else. The room was in great condition. No signs that it had been ransacked or there had been any kind of a struggle. Those are all good reasons to argue that whatever happened, it likely didn't occur in the room. To me, the most important reason is, if this was all about the jewelry and people knew they had it, there's no way in hell they'd just take what Catherine was wearing and leave the rest behind. So, what if there was a couple there that they knew or that befriended them? Maybe they're locals or have a place there. It'd be pretty easy to make them disappear if you owned some land and invited them over. No one's going to think to search your place. Or it could have been as simple as arranging a meeting. Would you like to come to dinner with us? We know this great little place 15 minutes away. You give directions that lead them into a more isolated location, and now, rather than robbing them in a busy city at a hotel, you're doing it on a quiet road in the middle of nowhere. Maybe they even thought about taking their room key and going back that night and digging through it after they'd gotten them out of the hotel. Maybe that was ruled out as being too dangerous or risky, but I don't know many people who would really be paying attention to who's coming and going at a hotel in a major tourist area in the middle of the night. One aspect of the case that's always intrigued me was not so much the hotel room, but something that was in it. Maybe it's just me, but if I've just completed the first day of a trip that took me 7 hours, and I'm finally in the comfort of my hotel room, the last thing I'm thinking about is anything related to business. Sure, Charles may have been a very business-oriented person, but I've always found it curious that he had financial paperwork and tax forms out on the desk. If you're just bringing them up to New York to give to your accountant, I mean, they were 1 week away from April 15th when taxes are due, that would make sense. But why are they all laying out? I'd be more inclined to keep them in a folder in my suitcase or briefcase just to ensure I didn't lose anything. They had their checkbook out, financial documents and tax forms in a hotel where they would be leaving the next morning. They'd had a sip of scotch, hung all their clothes, and at least one of them was doing some reading. I have no reason to point this detail out as though it somehow houses a clue that was missed, but I find it really strange. Maybe that's how Charles and Catherine were. They didn't take a lot of time to relax and keep their heads out of the business world, but they did just have 3 full months in Bal Harbor to go over these papers if they really wanted to. I don't know. That's just one thing in their hotel room that's always stuck out in my mind. But like so much else in this case, there doesn't appear to be any answers there either. To me, it always comes down to likelihoods. What's the most likely scenario? What logically makes the most sense and can explain away the absence of evidence, sightings, witnesses, and anything resembling a crime scene? Given the condition of the room and the fact that extremely valuable jewelry was left behind, I don't believe the crime occurred inside the hotel. Getting Charles and Catherine outside may have been something a suspect needed to do by one measure or another, but it's also entirely possible that they left by their own choice. Maybe they wanted to eat at a place they favored in the area, or the hotel restaurant didn't have what they wanted. I understand that Charles was a man who followed a pretty tight routine, but once he's already checked in and looking to grab some food, he's had a little bit of scotch, I don't think he'd be unwilling to take a quick drive to do that. If indeed Charles and Catherine walked out of that hotel, climbed into the Lincoln, and drove out of the parking lot without anyone forcing them, without being under duress, then the list of possibilities is seemingly infinite. An accident leads to them being in the water. Someone who's been planning to rob them sees the opportunity. Someone who just stumbled across them thinks they look like easy targets and takes a shot. In the end, we're left with all the same questions we have from the beginning. What could possibly have happened to the Romers? Where did their car end up? Why didn't any of the jewelry or credit cards ever get found? Not one person in more than 40 years has ever gone to police and mentioned someone who talked about robbing and killing a couple in Georgia in 1980. No thief or fence arrested has ever tried to trade information about expensive jewelry, a luxury car, and a murdered couple for a lighter sentence. If there's one thing we know, criminals talk. Someone out there knows what happened, if indeed this was a crime at all. Charles and Catherine Romer vanished on the night of Tuesday, April 8th, 1980, from Brunswick, Georgia. For 4 days, no one knew. By the time police were notified, they were already days behind and they didn't even have much of a starting point. They had a hotel room that gave no clues and a couple of witnesses who may have seen them or may have seen their car, but no one can confirm for sure one way or the other. 41 years later, the answers are seemingly further from our reach than they ever have been. People who knew the Romers, spent a lot of time with them, and were close to them in age are gone now. Anyone who may have targeted them likely is too, or is living in their senior years. The water holds a lot of secrets. We've seen missing people found after decades in their own car at the bottom of a lake 10 miles from home. It's not an impossibility, but finding one particular car beneath a river that has dozens may be more of a difficult task than it seems. Unfortunately, that's how things remain. Without a shred of evidence, a confession, or the miraculous discovery of Charles, Catherine, or that Lincoln Continental, the disappearance of Charles and Catherine Romer will remain open, unsolved, and extremely cold. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Charles and Catherine Romer, there aren't many resources to turn to. Newspaper archives have a lot of stories, but much of it's regurgitated information. A few books have mentioned the case, but in summary form only, and there isn't a whole lot of information available on official websites related to law enforcement either. If you have any information about the vanishing of Charles and Catherine Romer, please contact the Glynn County Police Department at 912-554-7800. It is case number 80-04-1449. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, Email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eric Sumpter, Heather Louise, James, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sentz, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brickeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Robert Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. If you haven't already, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated, but it's up to you. Share these episodes, spread the word, and maybe together we can help bring justice to those who have been deprived of it. That will conclude episode 173. I want to thank you all again so much for listening and supporting Trace Evidence, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.